So anyway, I'm to give you some information on nanotechnology today and its use in food. But first, how many of you know or are familiar with food science? Give me a definition. I mean, I've got something up there.
Penn State's all about degree.
Yeah, that's true.
I
That's true.
took a food science, I didn't get a degree.
Well, that's. Yeah, we're only the. I think there's only one other creamery that's still operating in the United States. Most agricultural schools have closed them down. And indeed, the building that we're in is basically a manufacturing unit on the bottom. It's the creamery plant itself, and they get all the dairy products from usually from the herds on campus, but they buy some out on in the countryside as well. Anyway, Penn State has one of the largest food science programs in the United States. UC Davis is the only one that exceeds us. And the numbers I have are 150 undergraduate and maybe 50 graduates, but I think we've gone up to 170 undergraduate and maybe 60 or 70 graduate students now, so we're quite large. And it has involves four disciplines, as you can see: chemistry, protein chemistry, carbohydrate chemistry, even flavor chemistry. Microbiology. We have a very strong microbiology group in our department. Some of them are interested in food safety issues, outbreaks and how you control pathogens. But the others are interested in more basic microbiology, like, now, of course, what's the hot topic in micro? No, actually, not so much in our group, but what? No. The biome. The bacteria that cover you and that are in your stomach and in your intestine and everything. That's the hot topic now. The bacteria actually that rule your life, as it turns out. And so we have a strong microbiology group. We also have engineers. They're involved both in packaging and processing. I remember when I first came to the department, one of the engineers was working on a project. People in the area would bring in issues, to the department and say, "Can you help us with this?" And for some reason, the canned beans that they were making were breaking up, and people like to open up their canned beans and see whole beans, not little pieces. And so he was working on trying to figure out what in the process was going on that would cause the beans to break up. And then we have an interest in nutrition. Right now, we have two young men in the department, one of who's very interested in the use of phytochemicals in treating obesity, actually, and also in cancer risk reduction. I think that's what Ryan is also interested in. And so the degrees that we grant are really very flexible. Students go into the traditional food industry. They'll go to work for Mars, for Hershey, for Kraft. But they also go into pharmaceuticals. They will go into the regulatory industry, FDA inspections and that sort of thing. And even some of them go into law. Looking at patents and things like that. So, this is what I was going to cover today. I just wanted to remind you that food science is working on food post-harvesting. So it's the stuff that happens after it's come in and been harvested, and then the processing and manufacturing that comes after that. So, just a reminder of what it is. Nanotechnology is generally defined as the science and engineering materials in the range of, I say, 10 to 100 nanometers. He's got 100 nanometers below, and of course, a nanometer is 10 to the minus ninth meter. And I like this next little diagram because it gives you some size comparisons that actually sort of makes it a little bit realer. This scale is set up as if you're a glucose molecule. So, and 1 nanometer is a glucose molecule, and you can see that a water molecule is a tenth of its size. And then as you move up the scale, you can see that a virus is about 10 nanometers. Sorry, that's an antibody, is about 10 nanometers. A virus is 100. And these are all smaller than bacteria and human cells, and it goes all the way up to the tennis ball. And this stuff here is about the range. Is in the range where nanodevices are thought to be would want to be developed. And these are just some pictures of some of the things that they're looking at. This is a slide that came from the National Cancer Institute. So the things that they're picturing here are things that they might be using in drug delivery. And they were even thinking of using carbon nanotubes to do that. And so nutrients, which your body deals with, and food scientists think that they deal with down here, are in this range as well. So this slide or graph was put together by a European marketing cooperation in 2004, and they very, very optimistically predicted that the nanofood market would be about $20 billion in 2010. Well, this didn't happen, and now they're predicting that that might happen 2 years from now in 2015. Actually, there are very, very few food applications out there in the food market that you would eat today. In fact, the area that is actually taken off in terms of using nanotechnology is in dietary supplements. If you, I don't know whether, have you gotten, been given the Pew resource website with the, yeah, if you go in there and look through, you'll find dietary supplements that claim that they're based on or use nanotechnology. Now, some of this is because food companies are sort of conservative. First of all, they've got, if they're doing it, they don't necessarily want to talk about it and let their competition know about it. But the other thing is that they are worried about how consumers will react to it. And I do know that IFT, which is the Institute of Food Technologists, just had a meeting in Chicago this summer about nanotechnology use in food. I haven't seen the presentations that were given there, but they're interested. Of course, you know, nanotechnology is out there in all sorts of other consumer products. I'm sure Bob shared some of those with you. So this is what we're going to go through today. I told you I was going to go through food safety and quality, food manufacturing, and food packaging, and then I've just listed the specific things that I'll be talking about. So we're going to look first at tracking, tracing, and monitoring. And one of the things that it could be used for, is to put more information on food packages. Nanotechnology has set up things now so that you can get a lot of information in a little tiny chip. And, of course, food packages have a lot of information on them already. They have the nutrition facts panel and all the other stuff that's on there, plus some advertising. And food package sizes vary, and so they have limited space in some cases and more in the others. And if you had chips, you could put the same amount of information on a given package. And so the idea is that you would, when you come into the supermarket, you would pick up a little scanner, and then as you run through the supermarket, you could use that scanner on the chip on the side of the package if you were interested and see what sort of information you could, extra information you could find out about that product. And I can guarantee you there will be apps on your iPhone that will be able to do this eventually. So it could, if you think more information will improve food labeling, it could improve food labeling. Then we have food traceability. Here you can see that, I guess you can't see the colors of the little dots very easily, but basically it indicates that information and about the ingredients and then at the processing and the transportation, they're all incorporated into a chip on the side of the package. And actually Walmart has been pushing for some way to detect where a package originated. And, you know, when Walmart gets behind something, these things happen. So this will probably be pushed along. But we need traceability for basically three things that I can think of. We have country of origin label. How many of you actually look at your package and see whether it came from China or not? Some people do. But we have country of origin labeling. But it would be nice if it was a little bit more specific than just country in some cases. And so one of the things they want to do is to be able to trace back and find out about where the ingredients originated. And when we have food outbreaks, that would be very, very handy if you could come down to a single ingredient and then you could go to that ingredient and find out where the salad mix originated. And then it can also be used as a veracity of a claim. You know, some people, how many of you think organic claims are true? You know, if they bear the organic label, now see, people are not sure. But if you had this sort of system for an organic farm and you carried it through to the processing, it would be a way to verify that this is indeed an organic product. Okay, so let's go on to manufacturing. The food industry does both processing and manufacturing. and they're sort of thought of as different things. The food mill, you know what a food mill is? You know what it's used for? Tell people what it's used for.
Oh, it's great for mashed potatoes.
Yeah, yeah, or you could... Yeah. Or if you're making tomato sauce at home, you could run your tomatoes, peel them, and run them through that. So that's a form of food processing, and you do it at home. Well, the industry does food processing, of course. Produces lots of frozen vegetables, which is basically just a matter of heat processing to, or canning to get canned vegetables. But it also does manufacturing. And the manufacturing, I think of as two different types. One would be where it takes ingredients that you're pretty much familiar with and it produces something that you can recognize, like a loaf of bread. Okay. Then they do other things where they put ingredients together and they produce a product that you don't know what it is until they tell you, like a Pop-Tart. If it were just handed to you initially, I don't think most of you would have been able to figure out what this strange loaf was. So the examples I'm going to talk about are mainly addressing the manufacturing end. So I can't use, lots of times in slideshows, pictures of real products. So this bottle represents a functional water. In the supermarket, there are lots of functional waters for sale. Lots of them are sports drinks. You know, they have water with added vitamins and whatever, you know, to give you more energy or whatever. And I found, this one actually represents one that I found in the supermarket several years ago. It actually says this on the label. It's to boost your memory and mental sharpness. That's what I need. With a mix of soy phosphatidylserine, ginkgo biloba, and other antioxidants that are supposed to be delivered directly to your brain using a patented system. Well, this is ingredient which, and antioxidants are typically not water soluble. You have to solubilize them. This is probably using a macro encapsulation system to keep these things in the water. So encapsulation is a really important technique because you can put an ingredient that might be sensitive into a capsule and then mix it in a food and it would be protected perhaps from oxygen, pH, or light, etc. And it would end up ending at, hopefully at the intestinal tract intact so it could be absorbed. And the capsules are made of linear molecules. Most of you may think of a fatty acid when I said it's amphiphilic in terms of water repelling and water liking. But there are other things. Phosphatidylserine is a phospholipid that could be used. But in any case, food chemists can orient these in different ways so that you can produce capsules that have different interior and exterior skins. Okay. The liposomes would be soluble in a lipid medium, and they would have an interior that was water. Whereas a micelle would be just the opposite. It would be able to dissolve in a water system, but would have an interior that would hold a lipid-friendly compound like beta-carotene. And so some of these compounds that they're using in these are flavors, antioxidants, and vitamins. And the purpose is partially to protect the ingredient. But one of the things that they're thinking about, and I'll say more about this later, is that it might increase the efficiency of delivery of these particular compounds to the intestinal wall so that more is absorbed. Okay, so many foods, a characteristic of our food system, the major part of our food system, is that foods have to travel long distances, so they have to be stored. And so we have to have methods to preserve freshness and quality as a result. And so a lot of foods are covered with macro coatings that do this. I'm sure you're well aware that apples and other fruits, as well as peppers, come with a waxy coating to prevent desiccation and microbial growth. But in addition, some of these pastries that you find that are like Intermin stuff in boxes, and also the candies that come out around in February for Valentine's Day, which are in boxes, also are coated with things to prevent oxidation and to preserve texture. And so the idea of nanotechnology would be that you could use smaller amounts of these compounds that they already use to produce the same quality on long storage. But they would have another function as well. So not only would they possibly allow the use of less material to perform the same function in terms of preserving quality, but they could be set up in layers so that they can deliver something to the person that's using it. In this case, the nanolaminates that are being tested are thin layers of food-grade material that enclose a layer of something else like an anti-browning agent. These could be put on apple slices. Dipping is the way that they think of doing it. And then these apple slices would be ready to go in the pie, basically, without becoming brown. But they can incorporate other things, microbials, flavors, colors, antioxidants, as I've said. And this would increase the shelf life and quality of foods. And this is just a drawing that shows you here's the surface of the fruit with the compound that is used as the base of the layer. This would be the antioxidants in here. In a, the little wavy lines are just the medium in which the antioxidants are solubilized, and then the outer wax coating. And so, again, this is something that could deliver antioxidants into the food system and perhaps to your benefit. And then there are nanoemulsions. Now, lots of foods that we eat are emulsions. Mayonnaise is an emulsion. All your salad dressings are emulsions of various types. And so what they're looking at in terms of nanoemulsions would be very fine oil and water mixtures where the droplet size is down in the range of 50 to 200 nanometers. And these would be clear rather than opaque. A lot of your salad dressings are really opaque, but these would have small enough droplets that the water that the light would pass through them. And one of the things that they could be used for is to produce lower-fat mayonnaise or ice cream. Bob's heard me talk about experiments that they've done where they, if you take water and pass it through a filter that has nano-sized pores on it, there's enough surface tension on the water when it pops out the other side that it'll form a little ball, and if it runs into a stream of fat at that level, the fat will coat that ball and you wind up with little balls that have a fat layer on the outside. And if they can do that and stabilize it, they could use it in ice cream, some mayonnaise, to lower the fat. What you're doing is, what are you replacing the fat with?
Water.
This is something the food industry does already. So that would be a way to do that. But it would give you the mouthfeel if they could stabilize it. It could be used in parenteral nutrition, which is when you're feeding an individual intravenously. They are even thinking of using these to carry bioactive compounds, so the bioavailability is increased of whatever is being carried in the emulsion. And the interesting thing that I really think is important is that it could be used to disinfect equipment surfaces where biofilms hide pathogens. One of the big problems in food safety right now is these biofilms that form on the walls and on the conveyor belts, yeah. So the biofilms can form on those, and they can form on the walls, and they're very, very hard to break up. And pathogens love these because that's where they actually help build them, and that's where they live. But these things could help break those down and disinfect things. So that's a food safety problem that would be helped. Then the other thing is nanofiltration. Many food processing procedures that are done actually require filtration afterwards. Sometimes when you do things with enzymes and other stuff, you want to pull those back out again. And so you want to filter whatever you produce, like your cider, you want to clarify. And then we've also got, when you're doing food processing, you go through a lot of water. And so this water, if it was released the way it was, you're through with it, it would really cause a lot of pollution. And so they want to filter that as well to clean that up. And so one of the things that you can use nanotechnology for is to produce filters that are much more highly effective in terms of filtering things out. And this is because of the surface-to-volume ratio change that occurs when you nanosize. So that would be one application that would be quite useful. Okay, I'm done with food. I'm going on to packaging. Do I have questions? Okay, I'm putting you to sleep already. Okay, we'll move on to packaging. Well, food scientists want to protect food from contamination to preserve the quality and shelf life. And so we've got microbial contamination, chemical contamination, the effects of oxygen, which can cause oxidation, water vapor, which can change texture, and light. And nanoscience might help improve packaging materials that perform these functions. This is actually one application that's already in the marketplace. It's a plastic beer bottle. You can see that Coors is using this. It's a nanoclay beer bottle. And why would they be interested in a plastic beer bottle if you were a beer producer?
Lighter.
cheaper?
Yeah, use it? Sold on the beach because people don't allow blacks
to use it. Oh, so okay. Well, I didn't realize that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, yeah. We'll see later. I'll talk about that. Yeah. So there's reasons for them to look for this. And so this company, Viridian and Nanocore, came up with this plastic beer bottle. And this is what it's made of. They're called clay nanocomposites. Basically, you mix a clay, and the one that they use is called montmorillonite. And that's mixed with nylon. And of course, nylon passes oxygen. The thing in beer you want to do is preserve the head. And then they mix it with these nano pieces of clay. And what it does is depending on the mixing, you can get these mixtures where the clay is all tangled up with the polymer. And probably they would use something like this. There, depending on the mixture, you can get different levels of incorporation. And what it does is it improves barrier properties so that they, if the oxygen is here on the outside, it has to go through an incredibly torturous path, much more torturous than this, to get into the beer. And so it preserves the head. And these things are stronger, better barriers to light and oxygen, and they're fire resistant. And then in answer to the question that you had, or the comment, you can make these that are biodegradable. You can have these blends of starch, polylactic acid, polycaprolin, and nylon. Polycaprolin is actually a synthetic polymer, but it's digested by bacteria very easily. And so you come up with these plastics that are have better mechanical properties, thermal resistance, and they can be recycled. So I will say, I guess I should say it now, is that in terms of where movement is going to be in terms of introducing these things into the food system, packaging is probably going to move faster than food. And then they're interested in active and intelligent packaging. Active packaging changes the conditions in the packaged food to extend the shelf life or to improve food safety and quality. And intelligent packaging is something that monitors what's going on in the package and then somehow gives information to an outside observer about the safety and quality of the product. And this is an example of antimicrobial active packaging. And basically what they've done here is if this is the packaging layer and the on the inside, they've incorporated a nano layer of starch that nanoparticles that include little, they may be single enzymes, that contain lysozyme, and lysozyme kills bacteria. And so the idea is in the food product, if the bacteria grow up to a point where they become a pest, they will work on the starch, release the lysozyme, and kill themselves. So that helps control the microbial growth. And then in terms of in terms of the other types, the intelligent packaging, the way they're thinking about that is that you might be able to come up with a dye that would change color when it detects an amine. When meat and fish decay, they release amines. And if you could get a color change that occurred, this could be on the outside of a package, and so that a consumer who couldn't smell very well but could look at a color would be able to tell that I probably shouldn't eat this, you know, because it's no longer any good. Okay, so I've gone through the things that I was going to cover here. Did I have any questions about packaging?
Well, are these theoretical or are they actually in practice?
The packaging things are not in practice, but they're all being researched. Everything here is under, you know, there's a food industry research lab that's looking at these. Even in terms of the encapsulation, there are even research projects going on in food science where graduate students are working on producing encapsulation methods. The problem with encapsulation is purity. You get a mixture. You get a mixture of full capsules, some that are not, and some of the free stuff. And you've got to separate it, and then there's the size business that you've got to narrow it down to. So there's a huge process of cleanup that has to occur after you set up the reaction. I wasn't going to talk about this. The major amount of research that's been done in terms of consumer perceptions of nanotechnology use in food has been done in Europe. There was last year an ILSI survey that was done in the United States. They do surveys every year. Did have a question about whether people had heard about nanotechnology in food. And roughly 70% had heard nothing about it. You know, because it's not really out there in the literature. It shows up in the newspaper every once in a while, in the New York Times or someplace like that. But it's not being covered by the media. And then, of course, there were some who said they'd heard a little, but if you put those all together, because people will say, I've heard a little to look good in the survey, about 80% of people have never heard about this stuff. And that's also the same level of ignorance, I would guess, that you see in Europe. And the research has been done in Europe. A little bit of it's been verified in Australia. Basically, consumers are more comfortable with things that are done in packaging than with anything that involves something you would eat. And this is even for animals eating it. And when you look at the characteristics, the things that consumers use to decide whether they like or dislike or they see a risk or a benefit to something, for nanotechnology, the exact same factors show up as for genetic engineering. So this is the reason the food industry is nervous about this, because we have this reaction to genetic engineering use, and now they're coming up with nanotechnology, and will the reaction be the same? So that was the reason I wanted to say toward the end here a little bit about regulation and what's being proposed in the United States. So we're going to look at the consequences. Now, all the information I've given you about these products, I always told you that there was a benefit associated with it. I didn't say anything about risk. And this is typically the way most articles about food nanotechnology will talk. You know, they'll say it can be applied this way, it can be applied this way, and it could be a benefit. And it's also true of many published papers. But one of the questions that you always have to ask, and I'm sure you're astute consumers when you buy things, right, is who does this benefit? Let's go back to the water in the ice cream. The water in the ice cream. You have to think about whether that's a benefit to you or to the company, because they get to knock out a lot of expensive ingredients. And they're selling water. Functional water is the same thing. You know, it comes out of your tap, but if we add a few vitamins to it, oh, you'll buy it and you'll spend three times the amount of money for it. Possibly, but you know, the problem is people substitute. And they would never do that in the creamery. You know, the low-fat ice cream is not an idea that would sell in our creamery. So, but anyway, in anything, and I'm sure you're aware of this, there are always risks associated with new technologies. Some of this risk comes because of the size changes. Scientists are discovering, and you've probably run into this, that these smaller things that are produced from macro ingredients have different properties. Many of them are more chemically reactive because of the change in the surface-to-volume ratio. That can be good or bad, depending on where that reactivity occurs. Their optical properties change. I'm sure they've told you about the clear sunscreens here. Oh, you didn't? Oh, okay. Well, titanium dioxide is typically the stuff that's used in sunscreens to deflect the UV rays. And if it's in the macro size that they use, that sunscreen would be opaque. But if you nanosize it, it's clear. It still prevents the UV rays from going through, but now you have a clear sunscreen. And actually, that's what's out, one of the things that's out on the market now, is these clear sunscreens with titanium dioxide are made with nano titanium dioxide. And one of the major suppliers are people or manufacturers in China. Then the structural properties change. Of course, you know about carbon nanotubes, electrical properties, and then the response to gravity. Now, in terms of response to gravity, there's lots of natural things that are also nanoparticles. A lot of the stuff that comes from engines, combustion, the pollution that's in the air, these are nanoparticles that we have been dealing with for a long time. And so they respond to gravity a lot differently. Now, if you're thinking about manufacturing also, you've got to think about this stuff floating around and how you contain it, which is the reason they take you to these rooms where they have negative pressure and stuff like that. Yeah, clean rooms. So it's not true that everything will be a danger, but there are going to possibly be negative effects. In food safety, actually there's a fair literature on the food safety concerns about its use in foods. But the concern is focused on the manufactured or the engineered nano-applications that are produced for a specific function. Not the natural ones. The food industry deals with natural ones all the time. When you homogenize milk, you convert the fat molecules into nanoparticles, and we eat those all the time. We use enzymes in making wine and cider and beer, you know, and we use those all the time. And then a lot of the things that are the nutrients that you eat in food normally, starch and other things, are broken down in your body, so you do nanoscience all the time. So these are not the problems. This is specifically manufactured or engineered applications. So one of the things it can affect is the metabolism of food. You know, our intestinal tract has lots of functions. We have a lot of bacteria. I mentioned that the interest in the microbiome right now. Tremendous number of bacteria, many of whom we had nothing about. It controls nutrient uptake on the intestinal wall. And we do have people with certain intestinal conditions and chronic diseases. And these bacteria do a lot of things for us. Some of them produce vitamin K, some of them produce short-chain fatty acids, which are important for us. But one of the questions would be how these particular bacteria react to some new manufactured nanoparticle that was part of the food system, or even came from packaging. It could affect the processes of absorption. One of the things that the public health, I'll call it the group, is very concerned about is the amount of sodium that's in our food. Okay. And already now, in food science, they're trying to convert typical crystalline salt to other sorts of forms that are more dissolvable and give the same amount of sodium, flakes and things like that. And so one of the things that probably will be looked at is converting salt crystals to nanocrystals, with the idea that you might be able to use less and get the same response. Now, the tongue, for taste, that might be true. Then it could also be more effectively absorbed in small amounts at the intestinal wall. The question would be, would this effective absorption actually give you a bigger dose? And how would this affect people with hypertension? Because in reality, when you are actually digesting things normally through your gut, you don't absorb all the salt that's in there. A lot of it passes through. So that needs to be looked at. And then we have people with gluten intolerance. Gluten intolerance, we already know that we have leaky intestinal sidewalls. Things can go between the cracks in the cells and get into the circulation. And we don't know what these nanoparticles might do. We have Crohn's disease, allergies, and a lot of people with irritable bowel. So typically now, when they actually do look at clinical studies to look at effects on people, there are attempts to make to look at what happens when you have people who have these intestinal diseases, what will happen with them. So hopefully they'll do that. I wanted to speak to then one of the dangers of nanoencapsulation. I've mentioned this earlier as a way to carry water insoluble and compounds into functional water. Those are examples, but there are many food products that are enriched with phytochemicals. Beta-carotene, lycopene, green tea has a compound in it that's sometimes used. And we also enrich foods with antioxidant vitamins and minerals. These phytochemicals, there are a couple of things about them. One is we don't know enough about them generally to establish an upper tolerable limit or even a recommended amount to eat per day. For instance, on the carotenoids, those ideas about what to eat are based upon the fact that people in epidemiological studies, where they're looking at fruit and vegetable intake, they find that people who have high intakes of fruit and vegetables actually tend to be healthier. Okay? So they can estimate from that maybe how much beta-carotene that might represent, based on the serving size of the And that might produce some effects of health for somebody, but that's not a daily requirement. They don't know what the daily requirements are. The other thing is that these things are generally not very soluble. And that's the reason the encapsulation is of interest, because it could deliver it more efficiently to the intestinal wall. For instance, blackberries, the active compound in blackberries that they're very interested in terms of cancer prevention for throat and neck cancer, 1% is absorbed through the intestine. It's very, very insoluble. So the concern is we've got it very insoluble over here, and then we go through this encapsulation, and now we really get a whammo full of it. So we have to figure out where there's a medium that would be beneficial but not be an overdose. And you do, I don't know whether you're aware of this, but they have found that beta-carotene back in the late 1900s can increase the risk of lung cancer in certain populations, particularly people who smoke, past smokers, or people exposed to asbestos. So we have to be careful about this. And then there are going to be downstream impacts of food nanomaterials. Silver nanoparticles can wind up in sewage plants. I don't know whether they talked about that here, but they can come out of the socks and other clothes. But, you know, food nanoparticles, engineered ones, can wind up in the food plant, or in the sewage plants, landfills, and then they can wind up in the surface water. So there could be downstream impacts. And one of the things that's sort of hidden in there is plate waste. You know, there's a lot of plate waste that gets, things that get tossed out in America that wind up in our waste stream. Okay, let's look briefly at regulation. This won't take very long. Most of the foods that we eat today in the United States, are their safety is regulated by the Food and Drug Administration. USDA manages a couple, meat, poultry, and eggs, but almost all the rest is managed by FDA. So I've put together a little summary of FDA's regulatory reach. The strongest control that FDA has over ingredients or things that get into the food system is for food ingredients or additives, and also for food contact materials, which is your packaging material. For these classes of materials, FDA requires pre-market approval. In other words, the company has to put together a package describing the safety and the efficacy of these particular things, and it has to be approved by FDA before it can be sold. They only have pre-market notification reach for dietary supplements and for company generally regarded as safe determinations. The dietary supplement industry is basically a self-regulatory industry. Niche has changed the regulation now. It's considered, everything's considered a food. And the only place where FDA has any control over entry is if there's a new ingredient that's going to be sold in a supplement that was not sold in the U.S. prior to the passage of the Disché law in 1994. Then the company has to provide some information about safety to FDA, and they have about 75 days to review it before it can be sold. Generally recognized as safe. I see somebody nodding her head back there who seems to know a fair amount about food. What's generally regarded as safe? Oh, okay. Does anybody else know what generally regarded as safe is? Well, when they passed the food additive legislation back in the 1960s, there was a whole bunch of stuff that was already used in food that people considered safe. So they sort of grandfathered all those compounds into a list, and there can be restrictions on how much of these can be used, but they're generally the food industry is free to use these. Salt, baking soda, things like that. And there's some discussion right now about taking sodium off the list. Now, what is going to be taken off the list? What did FDA just release this past week that they were going to trans fats? They were generally regarded as safe, and now they want to pull them off the list. And that means you have to be much more careful. In fact, that would eliminate it from food, basically.
We're having a lot of food.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But they've made changes already in terms of reducing the trans fats. And there are ways to get it out. But as it turns out, in terms of GRAS determination, a company can put together a panel of experts, their choice of experts, and introduce a new, have them review the evidence of a particular ingredient that they want to use that hasn't been used before in the food system, And if that panel thinks it's fine, they can, the company can declare it as generally recognized as safe. And they don't have to tell FDA about it. It's voluntary. And then post-market notifications for dietary supplements and cosmetics, if there is an adverse reaction out there that is reported, the dietary supplement industry has to tell FDA about it. Cosmetics, I think it's voluntary. So these two industries now are entirely self-regulating in terms of safety, practically. Now, FDA still can inspect plants for adulteration and cleanliness and look at labels to make sure that they seem to be okay. But they have a very, when you consider what they would have to inspect, they have a very small staff to be able to do that. So nanotechnology, use can occur in cosmetics, dietary supplements, food contact substances, food additives, and grass ingredients. And I've just tried to explain to you that FDA's ability to regulate nanotechnology across cosmetics, dietary supplements, and grass ingredients is really limited. And even now, there is no established rules that require a food company to declare changes in ingredient size. In other words, if they go from macro to nano. Now, this was all reviewed in the last decade, and it's still, some of it's still under review. And FDA was advised by its advisory group, and then there was a study done by the General Accounting Office about the GRAS system to address some of these deficiencies, particularly around nanotechnology. And so based on that evidence, FDA has done a couple of things, which I'll share with you. In June of 2011, FDA released draft guidance for industry specifying when an FDA-regulated product involves the use of nanotechnology. If you're going to regulate something, you have to make it very clear to the industry what you're looking at that you're going to regulate. And so they have two definitions. An engineered material or end product has at least one dimension in the 1 to 100 nanometer range, or the engineered material or end product exhibits physical or chemical properties or biological effects that are attributed to dimensions up to 1,000 nanometers. They enlarge the nanometer range there because particles like this tend to aggregate or agglomerate, so they can become larger. They can be used as coatings on other things, or they can be put into hierarchically manufactured image. So they had to enlarge the definition. And that would apply to foods, packaging, drugs, and all biologics under FDA control. And then the second piece they did was to issue draft guidance. This was to instruct companies to be aware that significant changes in manufacturing or use of nanotechnology could warrant a regulatory submission to FDA. A company could decide they're switching from macro titanium dioxide to nano titanium dioxide, and it actually is a food ingredient. It's an approved food ingredient because it's a whitening agent. They have used it in icings and all that sort of stuff out there. But if they decide to do that switch, they need to think about it. And what FDA is saying in this draft guidance is that they recommend that the company consult with FDA, even if they think it's safe, to ensure that FDA agrees with them that it's safe. So it's a consultation that's recommended, it's not required. And the guidance covers existing food and color additives, previously reviewed, any food contact substances, and any long-standing grass ingredients and newly determined grass ingredients. So they're trying to cover the whole waterfront here. The draft guidance was put out in 2012. I think they had a 90-day comment period, and the comments have come in. I don't think they extended the comment period as far as I know. And now they have to analyze those comments and decide what they're going to do about it. So this is just a recommendation at this point and not formal rule. Nanotechnology is part of our future. I think you all realize that coming to this course. These developments, of course, have potential benefits to society. And if nanotechnology use, including food, does entail some risk. And this last comment is sort of my position. It's that industry and regulatory agencies need to practice transparency. Need to let the consumer know what's going on. There was a report put together by the House of Lords in England, and it was published in 2010. And actually, it was a very good study. What they did was they went out and interviewed scientists and people in the food industry in both Europe and in the United States to find out what was going on in the food industry in terms of food nanotechnology. And what they found was that the food industry didn't want to talk about it. They didn't want to say anything about it. And they sort of chided them for this, because that's the problem with genetically engineered stuff, is that you don't want to talk about it. So people think you're hiding something, and therefore it's bad. And in fact, there was an editorial published in Nature, just sort of chiding the food industry. You need to talk about this if you're doing it. So people get used to the idea. And then I feel you need to offer consumers choice. Now, it may be that if FDA does approve these regulations in their form, that they may decide that a change from macro to nano is a significantly different, makes it significantly different than the original, then it would be required to be labeled. And the easiest way to do that is to put it in the ingredient list. Nano X, nano Y. So we have to wait and see what happens. So thank you for your attention. This is the, I think Bob said he'd given you this particular website, which is where they have a database of products that use biotech. And then the Pew Trust website on biotech, on nanotechnology is also useful. And I have volunteered in the past that if you have questions and I can't answer them, I'll answer them and send them to Bob and he can email them to you. Okay, thank you. Thank you.